Welcome to It's Never Too Late to Lose Weight, a podcast for women approaching 60 who have been successful at everything but reaching their weight loss goals. Tune in each week for tools and strategies to help you lose weight, create a strong body, and support a healthy mind. Here's your host, certified weight and life coach, Pat Beaupre-Becker.
Hi, welcome to It's Never Too Late to Lose Weight. Today, I have a very special guest, Ralph Sanchez, who's the author of an upcoming book called The Diabetic Brain in Alzheimer's Disease. Before we get started, I want to let you know that what we're talking about today, I have to read this disclaimer, okay? Because we are not doctors. I am not a doctor. Ralph is a practitioner. But anything that we're going to talk to today is for general information and for education. We are not substitutes for professional or medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. And none of the information that we're going to give you today in this podcast should be interpreted as a claim of a cure or a treatment of any medical condition. So listeners, you should not rely exclusively on the information provided in this podcast for your own health needs. You need to go to see your own healthcare provider, and any diagnosis, treatment, or medical conditions are strictly between you and your own medical doctor. Now that said, we want to really give you lots of information that you can use, of course. That's what we're here for, right? We're here to educate you on how you can live a healthier life as you go into your 60s, 70s, and 80s. So Ralph spent 20 years as a functional medicine specialist and complementary care practitioner. He has specialized over the past 18 of those years in Alzheimer's research. What he actually does is he's really good at reviewing the research, looking at it, and kind of really explaining it. You've heard of mansplaining. This is science-splaining. So he is explaining to us how we can apply science to our lives. And this is fascinating, because I've been around and you have long enough to know that there was a time when the science was for the scientists and we weren't really let in on all of the discoveries that were going on at the time. And now we have access to the brilliant minds and all of the research that we can have access to, but we really do need someone to interpret it for us. And that's what Ralph is very good at, and that's what we're going to do. So as I said, he's the author of the upcoming book, The Diabetic Brain in Alzheimer's Disease, and he has a website called the Alzheimer's Solution website, and that's focused on prevention and education, and you could go there and you can learn lots of things. So welcome, Ralph. I hope that was a clear and honest description of who you are.
Thank you very much, Pat. It's a joy to be here and to share with your audience. I know you have a great tribe that really is focused on weight loss and a very important component to that, which is the emotional component.
Yes.
I remember well, I haven't worked with people in weight loss, but I had a general practice. That actually goes back to 95 when I started my practice. So that's now close to 25 years.
Ah, 25 years.
The last 20 years have been focused on this knowledge base of Alzheimer's disease, because I realized I was at risk because of my personal health history. But when I was in a general functional medicine practice, integrative practice, I started out as an acupuncturist and incorporated a very progressive paradigm into my practice referred to as functional medicine. And functional medicine is really all about marrying the holistic model of the Eastern medicines that focus on the person, on the patient,
right?
You know, and looking at causes and underlying factors, and marrying that with the Western model, which is science and technology. You know, and I loved that convergence, if you will, because that's the way my brain works. I really like to work with people on an intuitive level and really kind of feel where they're at in their lives emotionally and psychologically. But at the same time, I like to look at the physiology to see what's going on in your body.
Yeah.
Because as you know, our body and mind are not separated. They're so connected. We're all one organism. We're not compartmentalized, right? So what's going on in our body really affects our brain profoundly.
Yes.
And that's some of the things that I've learned over the past 20 years is just how our bodies and the things that happen to us as we aging including the increase of belly fat, is really a threat to our cognitive health as we age.
Interesting. We'll get into a little bit of that, but I absolutely agree with you. I feel like being alive at this time and even being an elder at this time is really fascinating because there's so much research that's going on that we can actually apply. And the work that I do and the changes that I made in my life directly because of learning about the changes in our brain. And so neuroscience, though I'm not a scientist, it's been very fascinating to me. So I really have appreciated the way the many books that are written on the brain and the body and health. I mean, really, there's a wealth of information. And sometimes, yeah, you know, we have to discern which is the one for us. And I think functional medicine, what I love about it is it's like personalized medicine. It's like there is a disease, there may be symptoms, but how and why it's caused in that human being is not necessarily the same as in somebody else. So it's really important to have that approach. So why don't we just start by telling me, I know you're passionate about Alzheimer's and prevention now that you've been discovering that. How did you initially get involved in that research?
Well, I started to realize while I was in practice, this was the late 90s, in terms of my approach to learning and applying functional medicine, that I had some significant risk factors associated with neurological problems. I had had a very severe concussion when I was a young person. My head hit the windshield. I fell asleep while I was driving. And just one event of a significant brain trauma in your life really raises your risk for dementia later on in life. So I knew that. And then I came across information as I was in my practice and working and investigating things. And I was actually in a group of practitioners, and we would discuss our personal issues and how we could tackle them. And the things that came up for me were, I was in the landscaping field before I decided to go into healthcare. And I was young and stupid, and I had a business. I had a landscaping business, and I was using pesticides without protecting myself. And sure enough, it didn't take long before I started to feel pretty crummy. And I was able to get some help that through a very progressive practitioner. And I lived in Santa Monica at the time, which was, you know, one of the hubs of progressive medicine and the functional medicine movement, if you will, in this country. You know, a big city, San Francisco. California in general was just a great place to be in terms of that vibe. So I started to realize that my exposure to pesticides were a lot of why I was not feeling well. And like I said, this practitioner that I had gone to was able to help me in terms of how I felt, but she never connected what was the cause to my problems. She totally missed it. It was pretty amazing. And I started to realize, wow, this is why I have been feeling so crummy. So I knew how to address that through detoxification therapies and whatnot. But I came across another piece of information too, actually. The first was that at the time, those pesticides and herbicides that I was using were laden with mercury. And mercury in the functional medicine crowd was really understood to be a very potent toxin that could affect your health in so many ways. And of course, it's a very potent neurotoxin. That's why they always recommend that women that have conceived stay away from fish that might be high in mercury, because the exposures could expose their fetus. And that's not a good thing. That can be pretty bad for a child as he comes into life. But I went and did what's called a mercury challenge test to figure out if this was part of my problem. And my mercury was off the chart. And it wasn't because of amalgams, because that's really the main cause of mercury problems in people over time, chronic exposures related to your mercury fillings in your teeth, amalgams. I only had a couple, so that's usually not enough to really drive up mercury like that. So it was definitely the pesticide. You know, I wasn't eating a lot of fish, which can show up that way. Besides what's called this mercury challenge test, you're taking an agent to provoke this release of mercury into circulation. So if you're eating fish, that's kind of like an ongoing exposure. Your body usually can handle it depending upon certain genes, if you will. But in this case, it was pretty clear that I had had some significant exposures that had built up into my tissues. right? It's called a mercury body burden. And so between the brain trauma, the pesticides, the mercury, and then something else I won't go into later in life, all of that is actually in the preface of my book called My Story. But I started to realize I was really at an increased risk for brain health issues as I aged. And coincidentally, I saw my mother at the time starting to really decline in her cognitive health, and she went on to develop a dementia disorder. She died last year. I knew that because of the genes, and one of the things I always focused on with my patients was, let's look at your history really carefully, because whatever has been going on in your family, you're highly susceptible to.
Right.
My dad died of heart disease. My mother was in this dementia pattern. I didn't know why at the time, but later on I realized why. So I had the genes that were actually setting me up, along with all these other factors that would probably be even bigger problems later on in life if I didn't take a very proactive approach to. What I say now in my message a lot is that you can control your risk factors, having to do with one health disorder or another. We all know that. So we now know that you can control issues related to heart disease and diabetes. These are all lifestyle and dietary right. issues as you age, and then genes get kicked up because of those patterns. Well, it's the same for Alzheimer's disease for most people. As a matter of fact, at that time, when I was realizing all this, I had been to a seminar and I was reviewing the notes. This was from a well-known leader in the functional medicine community named Jeffrey Bland. And there was a mention there of a genetic marker for risk of Alzheimer's disease called APOE4. And I saw that and my eyes really lit up. I go, wow, nobody talks about this. How come? Right about that time, Alzheimer's was just starting to build up some momentum as to why, what's the cause, what do we do about it? Now we know the last 20 years, the information has just exploded in terms of our understanding. But back then, the science was still kind of stuck on what's referred to as plaques being the cause. And plaques is really, as I describe in the way that I write, it's the death and destruction of a war after all the battles have been waged. So plaque is just the end result.
Right.
There are like 20, we know now there's 20 to 30 years of stuff going on that builds up into those plaques. So all of that information, that genetic marker really set me off on a tangent of study. And about that time, this was about the year 2000, I said, that's it. This is what I really want to become an expert. And I was actually looking for something. I specialized in GI health. And back then, the whole candida thing was
here. Yeah.
And now a similar thing called SIBO, which is small intestine bacterial overgrowth.
Yep.
And I had realized all those things way back then, and I was really good at addressing that because I had that problem. But I wanted to write a book. I knew that was in my future. I wanted to really be known as an expert in something. And I decided that because of my personal history and what was evolving as a passion for this information, that this was going to be my thing.
Well, it's our benefit for sure that you got this passion. Yeah, I think it's fantastic. So we know that you're talking about Alzheimer's as being a form of diabetes, a type 3 diabetes. But let's talk a little bit about what we know about type 2 diabetes, especially about insulin resistance. And that's something that I talk to my clients about a lot because it can interfere so much with your hormones and your ability to know when you're hungry, when you're full. And so can you describe in your layman's term, tell us what is insulin resistance?
First, let's start with what is insulin. Insulin is a hormone. And it's a signaling molecule. That's really important to know because, you know, all hormones function as a way of conveying information that's triggered by receptors. So insulin comes to the receptor in the body, and that receptor triggers a host of mechanisms, a host of signaling mechanisms in the cell, which triggers another little item. It's called a GLUT, G-L-U-T, a molecule. And that molecule goes to the surface of the cell and allows glucose to enter through that. So insulin is really important in terms of glucose metabolism, glucose uptake into the cell so it can be utilized for energy metabolism. So what happens with people early in life is that if they're indulgent and the bad foods that we all grew up with, I grew up with them, you know, which are sodas and white foods, meaning white bread and crackers and pastries and stuff made with all of these baked goods, you know, that are so yummy. And sugars, of course, you know, they're all what are called high glycemic foods. What they do is they trigger blood sugar to go up. And that is a signal for insulin to come into the body and take that glucose out of the blood. Why? Because the idea is that you want to take up that energy into your cell to utilize it. But what happens if you have too much of that? Well, then it starts getting converted into fat, fat for fat storage, because your body says, well, we can't use it now. There's too much of this. So let's store it for later. Well, that pattern over time and time is that you start to gain weight because of the increased demand for insulin. The cells actually start to become less responsive. Mm-hmm. So that's where the idea of insulin resistance comes in. Mm-hmm. The cells become less sensitive over time. And there's a whole cascade of problems associated with insulin resistance, not being able to take up that glucose effectively into your cells, and this belly fat that starts to become part of that problem, not because of just the insulin resistance, because it's been a problem that has led up to that with the inability to use all of that excess caloric intake. Mm-hmm. But by now, you have this belly fat, which is starting to function as an organ of itself. What people don't realize is you're not just carrying around excess weight and fat, especially belly fat. There's a little bit of a difference between belly fat and what's called peripheral fat. Mm-hmm. In women, it's very clearly seen as the apple shape versus the pear shape, right? So if you've got all this fat around your belly, that's a very dynamic area that functions as an organ. That fat around your belly, it's called visceral fat or belly fat, functions as an organ. It secretes a lot of molecules, you know, so everybody knows about insulin to some degree, but there's another closely related hormone that's secreted by fat called leptin. People that are into this information, you know, they realize that, well, insulin resistance is a problem, but leptin resistance is a big problem too. Leptin is involved in satiety,
right,
signaling when you're full, and fat storage.
So you're saying when it doesn't work, you never feel full. And that's why people feel like they're hungry all the time.
That's part of the problem. So you become leptin resistant as well too. But fat secretes a lot of what are called pro-inflammatory molecules, which is a big problem for lots of health issues, but it's a big problem for your brain too.
Right.
Lots of studies on the connection between obesity, insulin resistance, type 2 diabetes, and Alzheimer's disease. And that's basically the message in my book.
Right.
You know, it's how all of this converges into this a model that emerged in 2005 as a type 3 diabetes, where your brain becomes desensitized and doesn't utilize insulin that well. It's a little different than what happens in the body, but the effects in the brain are profound, because insulin in the brain actually functions as a very important signaling molecule for memory and learning mechanisms.
Hmm.
So when your insulin sensitivity and the receptors in the brain are not functioning, they become dysfunctional, then your memory and learning cascades that are involved with insulin start to go south. It's now seen as a huge component to the Alzheimer's disease issue.
And is it the same cause as the insulin resistance that causes diabetes?
Well, it's related. So getting back to what I said before, so what happens in our body has a huge degree of effect in our brain.
Right.
So elevated insulin, elevated glucose. So when you have this insulin resistance, you start to have higher levels of glucose. So it's hyperglycemia, high blood sugar circulating around. That's the main problem in diabetes, right? So it's very damaging. it exerts a lot of problems related to inflammation and a related mechanism called oxidative stress. So when you have that high blood sugar, it's not only driving the disease process of type 2 diabetes, it starts to affect your brain profoundly as well, because that's another vector for inflammation. Right. That's another vector for oxidative stress. So all of those messages start to filter into the brain, and your brain starts going, wow, inflammation, oxidative stress, how are we going to handle this? So the brain starts to try and compensate. It actually creates more inflammation through the immune cells in the brain called the microglia. And then the issue of how the synapses start to function related to downstream mechanisms associated with this message of inflammation, which starts to trigger more amyloid plaque accumulation, if you will. But at the synapse is really where it's all happening. The plaque, like I said, is after all the battles have been waged. The battle starts to get waged at the synapse. Right. So insulin functions at the synapse as a very important signaling molecule. And really, what I really started to realize many years ago, and the literature really started to come forward, is that Alzheimer's begins when your synapses start becoming dysfunctional. So insulin isn't working, other receptors there are becoming dysfunctional. Right. And when you're not able to transmit information across those synapses so that the other cells can transmit that information, then you start losing a lot of the things related to memory and learning and maintaining your cognitive health.
So it's interesting. It sounds to me, from a layman's point of view, is like we need glucose, we need insulin, our brain needs it, our body needs it. But what's happening is it's so out of balance that everything is adjusting to compensate for the too much insulin, too much sugar, not enough exercise, all of the things that are lifestyle related. Yeah. So it's really trying to find the balance of, you know, the right amount of insulin, the right amount of glucose, how to burn your fat. It's like the engine is totally out of whack, and we just need to, from what it sounds like, from a lifestyle point of view, we can have a big effect on it. So let me ask you, most of my listeners are in our 50s, 60s, or 70s. So when you talk about the underlying risk factors, I know there's the genetic risk factor. You mentioned the APO. And then obviously it sounds like diabetes is one. So what should we be looking for? Remember, my audience, we're already doing our best to be healthy, or we're trying to learn to change our lifestyle to be healthy.
Right.
And obviously this is yet another critical reason why we should. What I'm hoping is that the answers are the same for all of them. In other words, the things we need to do good for our brain are the same things we need to do for that belly fat, the same things we need to do to stay healthy and keep a healthy brain.
They're definitely related. Now, the bottom line in all of these details, and I'll reemphasize this over and over, is that you've got to control inflammation and oxidative stress. And you do that through diet, lifestyle practices that reduces stress, right? Exercise. There's several ways that one can begin to understand all of that and how it applies to you. First of all, it's understanding your own unique set of risk factors. Right. And that's what I emphasize over and over in the book. And I'm finishing up a second book, as I shared with you, called The Improved Mind Diet, which is the complementary piece to understanding all this issue about what's going on with Alzheimer's and how you can address it through diet. And then there's a third book on the way, which is called The Dementia Antidote. And what that's all about is what everybody can simply do to keep their brain as young and as functional as possible as they age. And it's through a phenomenon called neurogenesis, which is converting new brain cells. Now, I know that you picked up a book on that topic as well, too. So the main
thing, I have about six of them.
So what is neurogenesis? You know, it's forming new brain cells throughout your lifetime, becomes even more important at midlife and later. And it's all the things that we're told about what to do to keep ourselves healthy. Exercise, having fun, social engagement,
right?
Diet. Supplements, all of these really are a wonderful pool that stimulates the formation of new brain cells. Now, why that is so simple and at the same time profound is early on when they were investigating this plaque association with Alzheimer's disease, they looked post-mortem at studies and started to realize that a lot of individuals that were not demented when they passed away, their brains were riddled with plaque.
Right. The Nunn study. That's the Nunn study, right?
Well, that's one of them. Yeah. So they were a little bit puzzled. So they go, well, maybe plaque isn't the cause because we're finding plaque in these people that were pretty cognitively intact. So now we realize that what has happened in those individuals most likely is that they were able to compensate for a disease process. And that's really well understood now. And that's referred to as brain reserve. So neurogenesis builds up this brain reserve. So even if you have a disease process going on in your brain, like Alzheimer's, you may be able to compensate enough to keep yourself cognitively intact until you pass on. Now, that's a great approach, bar none. But you still want to start looking at what may be some of the risk factors that you can control that I talk about all the time. And those are associated, again, with inflammation and oxidative stress,
right,
as it may relate to various factors going on with your health that are related to blood sugar management, mm-hmm. to issues related to vascular health. Mm-hmm. One of the things that's extremely important to your brain is blood flow.
Right.
Blood flow to and throughout your brain.
Right.
So that problem starts to arise when you have diabetes and heart disease. Those two things go together.
Interesting.
So as you gain weight and go more towards the insulin resistance side and go into type 2 diabetes, then heart disease usually follows. You
right.
know, if you live long enough.
Right.
And all of that starts to really create a problem in terms of the blood flow to your brain. And that creates a whole other set of circumstances that are related to stroke or the risk for stroke. Like what I saw in my mother is that she would complain about these little pinches in her brain. And what she was having these little mini strokes.
Right.
You know, they're called
TIAs. Yeah.
Right.
Brother had.
And so fortunately, because of what I knew, I was able to give her some stuff that helped her a great deal with that. That's why I started to understand why she was going into this cognitive decline. She had all this vascular health
right.
issue that
right.
was never adequately diagnosed and controlled by her doctor. She had hypertension. She was on a medication for that, but everything else wasn't being addressed.
Right. Yeah.
So unfortunately, that went south for my mother. But those are the things that typically happen with people. So you have to start looking at that through lab assessment. I have a personal health assessment that I created based on the main lifestyle dietary factors, but I included two biomarkers. Biomarkers are biological indicators of where you are in terms of any particular type of risk. Like high blood sugar is a risk factor.
Right.
It's a risk factor for diabetes, the risk factor
right.
for heart disease,
right.
and it's a risk factor for Alzheimer's.
Right.
So
right.
the same, a related biomarker, which most people are beginning to understand and recognize readily, is called A1C, or more appropriately, hemoglobin A1C.
Okay.
It's a biomarker that's used in your typical blood chemistries that's ordered by your doctor, or
right.
even you can order it through certain channels. But that's an indicator of, the doctor will tell you it's an indicator of your blood sugar control over a certain number of months, whereas your fasting blood sugar will be kind of like on the spot measurement. The hemoglobin is a component of your red blood cell.
Right.
So the A1C measures how much sugar has attached to that hemoglobin. But what your doctor doesn't tell you is that that's actually a measure of what's called glycation. And glycation is a very deleterious process. It's the main health issue associated with diabetes because as blood sugar circulates around and interacts with proteins and other molecules in your body, they become glycated. And mm-hmm. what is glycation? Glycation is the interaction of sugar with proteins, and it causes those proteins to become dysfunctional. A perfect example of the glycation process and what it may look like in your body is that that's actually a very favorite technique used in cooking. It's called the Maillard reaction. or the brownie effect. Mm-hmm. So when you caramelize foods with sugar,
You get
a browning effect, right?
Right.
Well, what about when you brown meats to get that nice roasted look? Well, guess what? You're actually creating this glycation process. And all that browning and all that interaction with sugar and proteins starts to turn your proteins in your body and the fats in there as well, too. It's a related process,
right?
But it starts to destroy them. It starts to create this whole pro-inflammatory process associated with that interaction. So glycation is very, very deleterious.
Right.
So when your hemoglobin A1C starts to crowd up into the 5.7 and above, that's when you're really starting to get into more serious glycation issues. That can be somewhat controlled through diet and supplements. But once you start getting into the range of 6 and 6.5, you're diabetic. And that's a big problem.
Mm-hmm.
But that whole process is what's associated with the diabetes disease process. That's the main thing, the high blood sugar and the glycation.
I'm never going to think of caramelized onions the same again.
Well, the thing with caramelization is not so bad. Actually, what I described as far as the browning effect with meats, that is really bad.
Now, is that ages? Is that what ages is?
Yes.
Oh.
So you want to get into that a tiny bit. So glycation.
The reason I don't want to is because I eat barbecued meat all the time.
I know. And it's the worst thing for you.
Oh my God, people, I'm sorry to give you this information.
Yeah, grilling? Oh my God. The toxins you create with grilling are absolutely through the roof.
Really? So interesting. Okay, we grill all the time.
Just Google it.
No, I know. I've read it.
Pro-carcinogens.
Yeah, okay. I'm going to have to really do some serious thinking about lifestyle changes for that one. Because I don't cook the meat. My husband grills all of our meats because I don't really even know how to cook.
Yeah, everybody loves to grill. I used to love it when I was younger, too.
But it could be a problem. And you could measure that, right? You could measure your ages.
Well, yeah, it's a more sophisticated analysis. But here's the takeaway on the food part of this. The literature now clearly indicates that if you're leaning towards this whole diabetes problem, if you're eating that way, that contributes to the disease process.
Right. But what if you're not? What if you're not leaning towards?
Then you might not have a big problem, but it depends on the rest of your diet. You have a lot of vegetables.
Oh, good.
Yeah. So if you're compensated with healthy antioxidants and anti-inflammatories in your diet, it will offset that.
Okay.
You know?
Okay.
So it comes down to an individual thing. You know?
Right. But it is good to know. And I am happy to hear you say that because I eat lots of vegetables.
Yeah. Well, that's really important when you're cheating on some other things.
Right.
And that's where most of your antioxidants and anti-inflammatories come from. You know, actually nuts are very important there.
Yes. Nuts. We do. Yeah. We have a very, very healthy diet, but we do a lot of grilling.
That's why I wrote the Improved Mind Diet.
Good. Well, we can't wait for that one.
Yeah, well,
I want to get the copy as soon as it's out.
Yeah, that will be in a couple of weeks. As a matter of fact, I created a page for your listeners.
All right, excellent.
And it's the Alzheimer's Solution /never too late.
Okay, great.
And there's three things on there. There's that personal health assessment that they can do and get some feedback. And then I have a discovery session, a 15 to 20 minute call if they have a burning question on the results of that test
or
anything you and I have talked about.
Okay, great.
And then there is a free preview of the Improved Mind Diet.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah.
Excellent.
And that will be, like I said, ready in a couple of weeks. And
okay.
I will send it to them if they opt into that request.
We'll have the links. I'll have all the links in the show notes. So, and we'll have a link to the to your website as well. Obviously, we've covered a lot of ground here. What would you say if you wanted someone to walk away with this without being overwhelmed with all the science, without being overwhelmed with a million things? What is the most important thing that you want them to have?
Well, focus on your lifestyle, focus on your diet, focus on your stress level,
right,
and know that if you have an extra 20 or 30 pounds around your waist, that that is a huge vector for inflammation.
Okay.
And you should be working with somebody about what that may represent for you.
Excellent.
In terms of a health risk.
Yeah. Excellent. Thank you. I know the other thing I wanted to ask you is, you know, I usually end my podcast with my favorite things, and I'm going to offer for you to give my audience, because part of, as we discussed, having fun, enjoying life is really good for your brain. It's really good for your stress levels, and it's just what we want to do, right? It's like we have, in my opinion, we have so much time left. It's like, I want to have a good time.
Yeah.
Spent a lot of time suffering. Now the time is to enjoy life as to the best of our ability. And so tell me one of your favorite things. What do you do to feel real joy and have fun?
Well, I was sharing that I love nature. I've always been a nature boy since I was a child. And I lived in an area called Carmel Valley. I live in Santa Cruz now, but I lived in Carmel Valley an hour away. And I was able to get to my favorite state park just a few minutes away from Carmel and not too far from Carmel Valley, called Point Lobos.
Okay.
And Point Lobos is on the northern tip of what's described as the Big Sur coastal area.
Oh, yeah. Beautiful.
But the Point Lobos is probably the most beautiful section of all of Big Sur. And I used to go there quite frequently because it was so close, and take a quick walk and just enjoy the magic of the area. I'll never forget when I first went to Point Lobos many, many years ago. I was standing there just kind of taking it all in, and I thought, this is just heaven here. So when I made it to Carmel Valley and I was able to get there on a regular basis, I was just thrilled by it.
Right.
And I haven't been able to do that lately. So I'm looking forward to actually getting back over to that area and spending more time doing that sort of thing.
Excellent. I'm going to have to find it and explore it myself. I don't think I've ever been there. I've been to Big Sur just kind of driving past. So I will definitely look
into
that.
Well, it's close by to Carmel, so it's a great weekend. You go to Carmel, you know, you enjoy yourself with some great food and the scenery.
Yep.
Carmel Beach, there's a little secret to Carmel Beach.
What's that?
So if you go to Carmel Beach on a hopefully sunny day, then if you walk to the north side of it, you walk to where it kind of dead ends, but you can actually walk up a little tiny path. It's only a few feet, and you're on the Pebble Beach Golf Course.
Oh.
So the Pebble Beach Golf Course meets that part of the beach. The beach is a beautiful big crest. And what you can do is you can walk along the edge of the Pebble Beach Golf Course.
Oh,
right?
They won't throw you out.
They won't. They don't bother people because not a lot of people know about this.
Okay.
So you can walk around the edge and just the scenery is spectacular.
Right.
I don't know if you've ever seen people play golf.
I have. It's amazing. Yeah.
But the scenery is spectacular.
Yeah.
And you can walk around the edge. And yeah, on one side, you got the homes overlooking Pebble Beach Golf Course. On the other side, you have this spectacular coastal scenery. It's really a delightful walk.
All right. I'll report to everyone when I get to do it. So thank you so much, Ralph. I really appreciate it.
I look
forward to the upcoming books and sharing the information, and we'll be in touch again, I'm sure.
Yes, Pat. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of It's Never Too Late to Lose Weight. If you liked what you heard and want more, head over to nevertoolate, that's number 2, .info/guide to download your quick start guide to jumpstart your weight loss plan and begin creating an amazing life you love.